From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Lots of news coverage about the state budget, but that could soon not matter at all.
The bigger dynamic is not the state budget per se. It's the impact of federal budget decisions on Michigan.
A PhD candidate gets scholarship money to research monogamous rodents from a pornographic website.
This brings attention to the fact that our government has changed its priorities for research funding right now, so we all need to be more open-minded about where that money's coming from.
Scientists headed to Washington for the March for Science.
You know, I hope the march is just the beginning of a movement. Somebody mentioned it as like a coming out of scientists.
Then a review of a new book from a Michigan poet.
It is a tacit admission that while death might be indifferent to us, we don't have the luxury of forgetting about our own mortality.
And we'll mix up a cocktail for you. Until all that, you'll have to be content with this newscast. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On Monday, the Great Lakes Economic Forum starts in Detroit and Windsor. Leaders will discuss the importance of open borders and markets, or the lack thereof.
And that demands really immediately fair trade with all of our trading partners, and that includes Canada.
But first, tomorrow, Earth Day, is when the March for Science will be held in Washington, D.C. Other marches are planned for hundreds of cities around the world. The organizers' mission statement reads, quote, "The March for Science champions robustly funded and publicly communicated science as a pillar of human freedom and prosperity. We unite as a diverse, nonpartisan group to call for science that upholds the common good and for the political leaders and policymakers to enact evidence-based policies in the public interest." Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha is one of the heroes for uncovering the Flint water crisis. She'll be in Washington for the March for Science, and she joins us now. So why are you attending the March for Science?
Absolutely. So, yep, I will be in D.C. marching along, hopefully with tens of thousands of folks who are celebrating science. And I you know, I can't see a reason not to do that. You know, my job, my everyday as a pediatrician, I use science every day to protect and restore the health of my patients. Anybody who's gotten an antibiotic or an immunization has benefited from science. And I feel it's important to be at this march to really kind of stand up for science, to reiterate the importance of science, and to really show to government that we need to value science, we need to invest in science, and we need to believe in science moving forward.
Do you think this will have an impact on Congress or the president in reevaluating the government's planned cuts in science funding and science-based regulations?
I hope so. It's hard to say, but, you know, I hope the march is just the beginning of a movement. Somebody mentioned it as like a coming out of scientists. Here's, you know, scientists and physicians and people who traditionally are not, you know, actively part of the political process. And I hope this begins an engagement of folks to, you know, get out of their labs, get out of their clinics, get out of their classrooms, and into hopefully the halls of government to share with legislators and government officials the importance of science. So I hope it is the beginning of a movement that will hopefully influence public policy.
Well, there's been some movement already. Scientific American reported in January that Earth scientists took to the streets in San Francisco last December during the annual American Geophysical Union meeting. Researchers and librarians raced to save climate data from federal websites.
Right.
Scientists flooded Twitter during President Trump's inauguration with updates about how science impacts everyday people. We're not really used to thinking about scientists as activists, although Flint certainly proved that they can be. How comfortable are scientists in speaking out in a way that they've really not done before?
Yeah, so I don't think it's like the traditional role of scientists. You know, this is not something that you're used to scientists doing. But, you know, as a physician who is also a researcher and an educator, it's in our job descriptions to be advocates. So, you know, my everyday as a pediatrician involves speaking out and advocating for kids. And I think it's part of all scientists' job description. We went into the field of science and public health to make a difference in the world, to improve our communities, be it through kind of bench research or you know, clinical work or whatever that we're doing. Our main goal was to make our communities better, to make the world a better place, to make it, you know, healthier and happier and stronger and greener. And I think scientists, you know, this reinvigorates them. This kind of, you know, instills why they went into this discipline in the first place and makes it more real for them.
The organizers of the march encourage people to be creative in how they dress and to carry signs and banners. So What will you be wearing? What's your message?
So that is a great question. So right now I am looking on my computer screen. There's a company called Vaha who is sending me a science dress. Which is exciting. They're a company that just makes science-based clothing, and I'm looking at a dress right now that's the periodic table of elements, and I think I'm either going to wear that one or a dress that has glow-in-the-dark neurons. So I think there's going to be lots of great outfits and lots of great signs and logos.
I understand you're going to be one of the speakers at the teach-in and rally that's held before the march.
Yes. So I think there's actually going to be like dozens of speakers, and I'll be one of the speakers. I'm also serving as one of the honorary co-chairs with Bill Nye, the science guy.
Oh, nice.
So it's an amazing honor. And I'll have 2 minutes to get on stage to really kind of share a little bit of the Flint story and why science was critical to identifying the Flint story and why we need to embrace science so that we don't see many more Flint stories.
That's Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. She's a pediatrician and public health advocate in Flint. She's been speaking about the lead crisis and public advocacy in Madison, Wisconsin. And when that work is wrapped up, she'll fly to Washington to participate in the March for Science. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Lester.
Michigan Republican legislators are divided when it comes to the budget this year. For example, Detroit News reports a Senate subcommittee cut energy assistance and food aid in what's known as Heat and Eat for the Poor. Chair Jim Marlowe called it, quote, flat out not good, end quote. He says he's received marching orders, though, from Senate Republican leaders in an attempt to cut the state income tax or pay down state debt. Here to talk about that are Ken Sikkema. He's senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. And Darcy McConnell, a former longtime journalist and current president and CEO of McConnell Communications, which operates as a communications strategist for state Democratic causes and clients. Ken, this week, Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff says there's no real agreement on the budget.
Lots of discussions about that. I mean, some of my caucus wants tax relief, some want to do infrastructure, some want to fix other issues like, you know, retirement things and things like that. So we've got some work to do on that, yeah.
What do you think about cutting food and heating assistance to the poor for any of those Republican priorities he mentioned?
Oh, I don't think that's a good idea. There's always going to be flashpoints in the state budget. But at the beginning of the year, what was starting to develop as a very dramatic battle between tax cuts and spending cuts is kind of dissipated. And I really think the bigger dynamic is not the state budget per se, it's the impact of federal budget decisions on Michigan.
Yeah, I definitely will talk about that a little later. That's going to be, and nobody knows, right?
No, because the federal budget process has just begun, and Michigan, the lion's share of our $56 billion budget is really federal money. So I really think that's the bigger dynamic going on here than the state budget per se.
Darcy, the Detroit News reports Michigan stopped participating in the Heat and Eat program a couple of years ago when the federal government raised state contribution requirements. That state money leverages a lot of federal dollars, though. What do you make of the move not to reinstate Heat and Eat, the program that the governor wants?
Well, I agree with Ken. It's a very bad idea, especially on the heels of a report from Kids Count, which says 1 in 5 children in Michigan are in poverty. So it just boggles the mind that these concepts are not aligned with the needs of the state. That they were able to work it out before to restore that, and I think that's what they need to do again. There's lots of other potential things that are on the bubble, you know, water quality, you know, the whole issue of the funding for Flint, infrastructure needs. And so, you know, you just can't understand why these kinds of things are being raised as possible cuts at the same time that they can take time out to legalize switchblades. So I just think they need to really get the priorities straight.
One of the hallmarks of Governor Snyder's time in office is the legislature has managed to approve a budget on time. That's important because, you know, schools need to submit budgets, and they can't do that until they understand the state's budget. Ken, with so much division, what's the likelihood of a budget approval on time?
Well, when they say on time, they mean sometime in June, and the fiscal year for the state doesn't begin until October 1st. Now, my own view is, okay, it's important to get it done as early as you can because the school budgets locally start July 1. But it's not the be-all and end-all. I mean, there are some big issues, and until you know what the federal budget cuts look like it's really hard to put a state budget to bed.
And the fiscal years run concurrently, right, between state and federal?
Correct.
So any budget planning we make is just guesswork at this time until we see a federal budget, correct?
It is. And the implication is if you did a state budget, got it done in June, and the federal budget doesn't get done until, you know, in the fall, and it's going to have major impacts, you basically have to revisit the state budget. You know, this issue for low-income energy, put it in perspective, the federal budget, the Trump budget, proposed eliminating federal assistance for low-income energy assistance to all the states, and that's a $165 million grant that comes to Michigan.
Darcy, I'd love to hear your view. I mean, whatever happens to this state budget, as Ken has mentioned, the federal budget will mean fewer dollars going to state programs. How do you think that's going to turn out over the next couple of years?
I mean, there's certainly some really draconian cuts that are proposed at the federal level when they start talking about, because you've got to remember that, you know, most of the communities across the state are still reeling from revenue sharing dollars being gutted, and they kind of tax themselves to death, so they probably lean on some of these other funding programs even more so now. So it's a fear, but that doesn't preclude the legislature from saying, you know, these things matter, these things are important, and so we're going to focus in on those issues. And so that's why, to me, you can still say, well, you know, we'd rather maybe make sure kids are fed and warm over, you know, this obsession with tax cuts and some of the other things that they're talking about.
That's Darcy McConnell, a former journalist and now runs McConnell Communications, helping Democrats. Ken Sikkema is former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate. He is now Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks, Lester.
Thank you.
Coming up, the craze of craft-made beer. Yum. New Holland's Beer Evangelist is touring the nation to figure it out.
I feel like story is the great equalizer in terms of, you know, reminding us to drop our shoulders and encourage people that it's easy to step in and try something new. And it's the taste, it's the flavor, it's the experience. If it's something you're not tasting, there's still a feel to it.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Theo Katzman is coming back to Ann Arbor for a one-night open-air concert featuring a few of the area's beloved musicians. While Katzman is still the drummer and guitarist with the funk fusion band Wolfpack, he's been promoting his latest solo album. Heartbreak Hits came out in January of this year. We all know the powerful emotions that come with love and loss and heartbreak. Katzman says he tried to confront those emotions in his songs.
My father passed away. I had a breakup. I had a bunch of career changes that were sort of changing how I think about myself, from a guy trying to be a producer and a writer for other people to realizing that I wanted to be more of my own artist.
Katzman says he's learning to let go of expectations. And of course, with his wit and a sense of humor, he brings us a fresh take on heartbreak. We caught up with Katzman on the road, and he gives us some insight on his creative process in three of his songs.
Caught your teardrops with my shoulder when you cried. I called in sick so I could comfort you all night. Now you got cold feet, well just let me break the ice, yeah.
Hard work is a tricky one. It's like kind of a complicated emotion. It's really about the temptation to feel self-pity and righteous anger in the wake of a breakup, which I know is a common feeling for a lot of people. But the song itself is really more of me taking a shot at that feeling and not me taking a shot at a person or a lover or anyone like that. The song for me is summed up in the last line of, I know it's worthless, but for what it's worth, I put in the hard work. It's like this person who's like, I know this is the wrong way to feel, and I know this is bad, and I know this is going to get me nowhere, but damn it, I feel that way. Well, I am from New York. I was born in Manhattan. I grew up on Long Island. And when I was 18, I went to the University of Michigan, and I really just came of age as an adult in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Outside of the university context, I became a member of the music community in Michigan at large, and it was really a 7-year period for me, school for 4 years and then 3 years of just living in Ann Arbor and working in the community and teaching at the Ann Arbor Music Center and working at Mani Osteria and having a catering job and, you know, stuff like that that was really fun. And I have pipe dreams of being a chef one day, but it's even harder than music, so not going to happen. But but yeah, Michigan really shaped me as a person, and everything that has flown from that, both professionally and personally, has just been, it's kind of where I feel like my whole life starts in a way.
Looking out my rearview mirror, the miles behind don't disappear like they used to. When I was with you.
Good to Be Alone is really a very honest song, and it's really a love song, and it's about missing something that you had with someone. I painted it in a romantic context, but it really could be about any kind of loss of a person. Just noticing that the experience of living feels somehow muted without that person in it.
On and on. Yeah, it's good to be alone.
But there, I think, is an inherent irony in the phrase, it's good to be alone, because it's really, we don't want to be alone, you know? We want to be with people, and we want to be in communities, and we want to be in relationship with one another, but it is important to ground yourself in yourself. So that's really what that song's about. Well, there's another song in the record called Love is a Beautiful Thing, and it's, again, it's me exposing an emotion. I really wanted to write about jealousy on this record because I feel like I'm coming up with an original take on it. Maybe I'm not.
Love is a beautiful thing unless it's you loving the
to just put it out there, like this feeling of, oh, love is so great unless it's not being given to me from you, and then I just can't understand how it's a good thing. If you weren't listening to lyric, you might be like, oh, what a sweet song, let's play it at our wedding, but then you might be like, wait a minute, we can't play this at our wedding. Listen to the lyrics. So all my favorite songs do that, you know. Only the Good Die Young by Billy Joel, almost every Bob Marley song has some kind of amazing disconnect between, or tension, I should say, between how jovial the music is, but the lyrical content is very heavy, and I really like that.
Theo Katzmann will be in Ann Arbor tomorrow night for the music festival Rock the District. His latest album is titled Heartbreak Hits. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Love is a beautiful thing. Winter's rage has softened into spring. Love is a
The Beervangelist is on the road, New Holland Brewing Company's vice president of brand and lifestyle, which might be the best title ever, is touring the nation to figure out the craze of craft-made beer, craft spirits, artisanal cheese, honey, jewelry, guitars. It's kind of like the American version of our Artisans of Michigan. Fred Beltman, how long will you be on the road?
We are on the road about 35 days.
Why this trip now?
Well, this is something that has been bubbling up in me for a while. I've had 25 years in the craft beer business and slightly less in craft spirits. But I've really seen through my career and through my work of bringing attention to this that it's more than a sales trend in one product category, that I feel like there's a cultural shift of people caring more about what they buy and what they support, and that it's cross-category, that I'm out to kind of answer those questions that I've had myself of there's something bigger going on here. And I think it's great for the makers, but it's also great for all of us because we have higher quality things in our lives.
What ties all of this together in your mind? Because when you start talking about craft made, that's wide.
It's very wide, and it's also personal. You have trade associations and makers looking to define the word, which is ultimately a personally subjective word. I think that at the end of the day, the consumer decides what they have a deeper connection to. And I find that to be the more personal description, is that it's when people know who's making something, they know why they're making it a certain way, and they value it in a more personal way. They value the connection. That, to me, ends up being what we consider to be craft or handcrafted or whatever the term is in any given category. But I find it to both be wide and loose at times, but it also seems to, pardon the noise here, we're on the streets of Brooklyn.
Okay.
But it also, while it's wide and hard to define, it also seems to have more impact than some label like organic or all natural or these other terms that may be regulated, but at the other time they're manipulated as well. So this is all about the question of why do consumers value certain things, and I believe there's some links to the connection and how they feel about the process and the why and the who.
That's a good point right there, the who, because people are going to farmers markets because they want to talk to the farmer who grows their food. They want to buy Michigan craft beer because they feel like that's closer to them, and they might even know guys like you. Why is that important to us?
Well, that's a big question, and that's what I'm hoping to get more answers on. I have my own theories, and of course I'll share them with you, but what I wanted to do, thinking about this project, which is ultimately a book, this Craft Nation that we'll spend the rest of this year working on, but we're also putting information out other ways. But I wanted to make sure that when I shared this subject with people that I wasn't just giving them my opinion. We're in the process of talking to not only makers, but other people that are around and saying, what are the multiple versions of why we value it? Because it's definitely happening. We've seen major growth and major, not only in the number of producers, but also in sales in so many different things. If you look at coffee and bakeries and butchers and going outside of food and drink into other products and jewelry and woodworking and clothing, people are reading labels, even if it's someplace far away. This is also beyond a local movement, that if people have a sense that they can reach somebody and they can understand the provenance and the path of something a little more, that's part of it. So you're right. It is local businesses, because I can go talk to a farmer at a farmer's market and ask him what I should do with this product or what, you know, how it was grown. I can get in more information. It's available to me. It's the same thing with small, transparent, available producers, because communication is so much wider now that I can find out about how a knife was made in Seattle, even if I'm ordering it to have it shipped to me in Michigan. We were talking to Roger Sadowski, who makes guitars in Long Island, and his business is largely international now, where it started as serving the session musicians of New York City. People are spending thousands of dollars on guitars from him and having them shipped all over the world because they believe in that connection, and they know they can call up and talk to Roger and have a bass or guitar made to their most aspirational desires.
Let's talk about your trip just a little bit. You're not traveling alone. Tell me about your traveling companion.
Yeah, so I'm traveling with Kyle Bice, who's an artist. We've done many collaborations together. One of his projects is beer portraits, so he paints using beer as the paint.
Right, that caught my attention. How do you paint with beer?
Well, pretty similar to watercolor. He's dipping the brush in typically dragon's milk out of our portfolio, a nice dark beer, and he paints flat instead of upright so that it doesn't run and it dries a little slower than paint. But he's basically using the hue of the way the beer dries on paper, and layering on top of that in several layers and creating a kind of a sepia tone watercolor. And he's very good at portraits, so he's taking a lot of photographs on this trip. Then as we go, he'll catch some more time and be painting portraits of the people and the characters in our story. He's very good behind the camera as well, and we're good traveling partners. We're both curious. His art, you know, an example of what we're talking about, and so is my business. We both have a collaborative and similar interest in story and adventure and going out to find it and then sharing that in a creative way.
You were quoted in an MLive article about the trip as saying, "We'll be intoxicated on experience." And I thought that was such a perfect statement from New Holland's beer evangelist. But what sparked this idea? What intoxicating experience are you trying to find for yourself?
Well, I mean, I've always been captivated with story and storytelling. And I think that it's kind of the meat on the bone for the people that I'm trying to share this with, whether they're already passionate about things. I like the fact that I try to teach people that in the world of beer and spirits and food and drink, there's no such thing as advanced and beginner, and that we're inviting people to kind of enhance their lives with choices that we think will be interesting to them. If we dismiss their previous choices or make it seem like you have to study to come into this world or I know more than you, we're really not opening the door. We're creating a divide. And so I feel like story is the great equalizer in terms of, you know, reminding us to drop our shoulders and encourage people that it's easy to step in and try something new. And it's the taste, it's the flavor, it's the experience. If it's something you're not tasting, there's still a feel to it. And when we get the people that know these things to tell their stories and share why they make it a certain way, share why it's worth the effort, share why they love it and how they use it, that story is so much more inviting and captivating and encouraging to bring people to care more about it than it is talking points or selling points and talking about this qualitative difference. I do think it's a quality experience, but I'm intoxicated and I get encouraged and fired up and wanted to set on this odyssey because I'm hungry for story and for hearing from the people why this matters. And I think that's the same thing that will get other people excited that are either in it already and have learned another layer, another depth of something that they didn't know before, or somebody who's maybe hasn't dipped a toe in the water yet and saying, I don't know what all the fuss is about, but I think hearing a story might get them to lean forward and take another step in rather than let them think that it's not for them. Caring about what you bring into your life is universal and is available to everyone.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about your experiences reading it in the book. That's Fred Biltman. He's the New Holland Brewing Company's VP of Brand and Lifestyle. Hey, enjoy your trip.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
You've been on the search for new Michigan products for cocktails. What'd you find?
I found something that's new to me, although it's been out for a couple of years. It's from Coppercraft Distillery in Holland, Michigan, and it is an Applejack.
Oh, okay. What kind of cocktail did you decide to make with that?
I'm making a cocktail called the Jack Rose, and this is a classic cocktail. It was really popular in the 20s and 30s, but while other cocktails from that period, like the Martini and the Manhattan, have come roaring back, Jack Rose is still a little bit of an underdog.
How do you make this thing?
So it's 2 ounces of our Applejack, 3/4 of an ounce of lemon juice, and then 1/2 ounce of homemade grenadine, and that's really important.
Homemade grenadine. Why don't you just buy some off the shelf?
Well, because grenadine in these classic recipes was actually a pomegranate syrup, and what you buy in the store today is just artificially flavored and artificially colored corn syrup. And
yeah, nobody's a big fan of corn syrup these days.
That's right, and it just doesn't taste good either.
So how do you make it?
Well, it's super easy, and that's why I wanted to talk about it today. So now that pomegranate juice is so popular because of its antioxidant and health properties, it's really easy to buy. So you just take a cup of pomegranate juice and a cup of sugar, heat it up on the stove just until the sugar dissolves, and that will be better than any grenadine you can buy on the shelf.
Well, that's simple enough.
Sure, and if you want to make it a little bit fancier, give it a little more depth of flavor, you can just add a tablespoon of pomegranate molasses. You can find that at any Middle Eastern store, which we are blessed to have a lot of here in Michigan.
And it really makes a difference in the taste of the cocktail?
Absolutely. I've done side-by-side comparisons in my classes, and people are amazed at the difference it makes.
All right, I got to verify, okay? So I'm going to take a sip. Oh, I like that one. That's good. That's really great. Now, the grenadine It does have a fruity flavor, and I have used grenadine out of the bottle, so I know that it's got flavor, but it's not, you would never guess that it came from a fruit.
Right, because that stuff didn't, but this definitely does, and combined with the fruitiness of the Applejack, it's definitely a really bright, fruity cocktail.
Well, thanks for finding this, and thanks for the recipe.
Cheers.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. Coming up, we'll meet the winner of Pornhub's college scholarship, a PhD candidate studying monogamous rodents.
The more I watch animals have sex, the more that I realize, you know, all of us really are also just very complicated organisms that are trying to also reproduce.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Grand Rapids native and poet Kathleen Magooke is out with a new book of prose poems. Fellow writers say her words continuously remind us that the dark angel is always nearby. As a part of our ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark, writer John Freeman has this review.
The prose poems in Kathleen Magooke's latest collection, Heart in a Jar, oscillate between the elegiac and surreal. How can we use the poetic imagination to cope with loss? Magooke asks her reader. Throughout the collection, we get references to dead family members, dead dogs, as well as a series of epistolary poems addressed to death itself. This is not a dark book, however. The stock this writer places in the redemptive possibilities of the human imagination lend this project a surprising hopefulness. In his blurb on the back of the book, American poet Gary Young writes that in these poems, death is less a sinister, spectral force than an awkward, neighborly presence. This evaluation is only partly right. While Magooke effectively utilizes the prose poem to deflate some of death's ominousness, the sense of human finitude is internalized rather than neighbored. In the opening poem, Dear Death, Magooke suggests, let's pretend you forgot all about us. Yet in Mended Too, she writes, I wonder who might come to my funeral, although I know I should not wonder about a thing like that. I am not sure where my mother and father's love for me has gone now that they are dead. It is a tacit admission that while death might be indifferent to us, we don't have the luxury of forgetting about our own mortality. There are too many moments when, quote, our dog was run over, when our friend was drowned the day his brother won the spelling bee. By addressing this personification of death, at times sardonically, and fusing the book's tender elegiac mode with her own brand of surrealism, Magooke offers the reader a way to subvert death's ominous power through the poetic imagination. As the book progresses, the poems and poem titles get stranger and more playful. Monkey Island, Tornado Machine, The Day After a Girl Sprouted in the Flower Bed, and we encounter surreal lines like all winter our mice laid eggs under the stairs near the furnace, and quote, the monkeys inside me are sick of speaking the wrong language. We can't subvert death, but the imaginative works we leave behind can re-envision it as something other than an ending, as quote, an angel arrived hungry, wearing a crown of tiny pine cones, for instance, or, quote, a single egg suspended like a jewel from which a new world might hatch. Death, in other words, is not the limit of the human lifespan, but the limiting of the human imagination. In the prose poem, Magooke has found the perfect formal vehicle to carry both her philosophical insights and her lyrical gems. And she puts them to work in her collection, Heart in a Jar, to transform death into an absurdity, echoing and contemporizing John Donne's edict, Death, be not proud.
John Freeman publishes poetry under the name Cal Freeman. He's the author of the book Brother of Leaving and the chapbook Heard Among the Windbreak. His review of Kathleen Magooke's Heart in a Jar is part of our ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark. You can find his review and others at michiganradio.org. We're going to talk about an immigrant student, the mating habits of a rodent, and a pornographic website, and I'm not kidding. Natalie Navarez joins us now. So first, I want to start with, tell me about your parents.
Yeah, so they were both migrant farm workers. My dad still is a migrant farm worker. My mom now works at a migrant Head Start. My father started working in the fields when he was done with third grade in Mexico, and my mom started when she finished sixth grade in Mexico. And from then on, they both worked with their parents alongside them in the fields.
And when you came along and your siblings came along, you were fixing dinners or lunches for them to carry with them out in the field and everything else. According to an article in the Washington Post, you went to college, actually got your bachelor's degree by age 19. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I didn't do that. Now you're a PhD candidate at the University of Michigan. What is your doctoral thesis?
So the title of the work is Dopaminergic Regulation of Pair Bonding in the Socially Monogamous Prairie Vole. I look at how dopamine, the neurotransmitter dopamine, regulates the development of these monogamous bonds in a rodent. And then I also look at the brain changes that happen after that.
So monogamy is not all that common in mammals, correct?
Yeah, only 3 to 9% of mammals exhibit monogamous behavior.
Okay, so you applied for a scholarship to finish up your studies, studying the monogamous behavior of these prairie voles. Who sponsored that scholarship?
Pornhub.
What is that?
So that is an online pornography company.
How did you find out that they were offering scholarships?
I actually saw it on – there was a variety of stories on it, kind of BuzzFeed type stories about how funny it was that a pornography company was sponsoring a scholarship. So I think most people thought it was kind of a joke.
And you didn't?
No, $25,000 is not a joke.
Well, yeah, it pays for school. But did you have any reservations about applying to a porn site for scholarship money?
Yes, I did. I understand that there are issues that are specific to the pornography industry. However, ultimately, I think that I'm a really good candidate in general to get the funds, and I'm going to do good things with those funds. And I also think that this has been a great opportunity for me to speak about my background and the prairie voles, which I love being able to talk about. So I think that this ultimately is a good thing.
You decided that, you know, Pornhub might be interested in your research because it deals with monogamy, which Pornhub might have an interest in. I'm just wondering if your fellow researchers are kidding you about getting this scholarship or not. Do you get some ribbing?
I have had such a fantastic response from everyone in the field. The only negative responses I've gotten have really just been random comments on the internet from people saying maybe she got it for because of her looks or for this other reason, which I think is actually a great example of what happens to women in STEM. But I think that the response from the science community has been amazing. They've all pretty much expressed that they think this brings attention to the fact that our government has changed its priorities for research funding right now. So we all need to be more open-minded about where that money's coming from.
You know, I don't know Pornhub. I don't know what they put up. But in many cases, pornography is exploitive of women. And I wonder if that was a concern of yours. Did you go check them out before you did the application?
Well, I think that this is funny because it's been a question that I've been getting a lot from the time that I did get this scholarship. So a lot of people are asking me again, how did you find out about the scholarship? A lot of them are insinuating, oh, well, did you see the ad for the scholarship because you were watching pornography? And the thing is, that's part of the problem that society has with pornography and why pornography seems to portray a very aggressive, male-driven stereotype of, you know, docile women. So I don't think women's views are really or interests are portrayed very well in pornography. But again, that's because society kind of keeps women from expressing those things. So I think it's funny that people are asking me, oh, did you find it, suggesting that maybe I found it because I was looking at pornography? And it's like, well, what if I did? What
right.
if I had?
That's the thing. I was talking to the producer just a moment ago because we're kind of a hypocritical society because in the U.S., the most visited web sites are pornographic sites. And yet it's always taboo or you're always looked at as, you know, a lesser person if you indulge in that. I want to ask you about your actual research for a second. So why is research into monogamous prairie voles important? What are we going to learn from that?
So I think that there are a lot of human applications. So in general, having positive social attachments is great for a lot of different aspects of human health. And the flip side to that, being lonely, is correlated with a lot of negative health outcomes. Additionally, for example, kids that have autism, learning about social attachments can help us understand how we can help individuals that are on the spectrum being able to have social interactions a little bit better. Lastly, there are also a lot of very important points of convergence between social behavior, which is a motivated behavior, and other behaviors that are motivated behaviors, such as drug seeking.
In the end, of course, as we've noted, Pornhub is a website where people can go to watch other people engage in sexual activities. The last line of the Washington Post piece quotes you as saying, I look at animals have sex all day, so many hours of my life. It gets tedious. There's a little irony there, right?
Yes. I'm actually very grateful to the Prairie Voles for teaching me really a lot of lessons in life. But I think one of those has really been detaching me from all of these like stereotypes that we have in society about sexuality, just because the more I watch animals have sex, the more that I realize, you know, all of us really are also just very complicated organisms that are trying to also reproduce.
That's a good point. That's Natalie Navarez. She's been awarded a scholarship by the pornographic website Pornhub to continue her studies on the brain chemistry changes experienced by prairie voles as they bond as a monogamous couple. Thanks for coming in and good luck.
Thank you.
On Monday, the Great Lakes Economic Forum starts. It's being held in Detroit and Windsor. This is the third forum held by the Council of the Great Lakes Region. The council is made up chiefly of business, government, and labor union organizations. Here to talk about the Economic Forum is Mark Fisher. He's CEO of the Council of the Great Lakes Region. Give us an idea about how much trade there is between the two provinces and eight states bordering the Great Lakes.
So when you look at the Great Lakes region and geographically, for us, that includes the eight Great Lakes states, so New York to Minnesota on the U.S. side and then Ontario and Quebec on the Canadian side. You know, as a regional economy, it represents roughly a $5.8 trillion U.S. dollar economy. And if you were to put that into country terms, that would be the third largest economy in the world behind the United States and China. So together as a region, it is an incredibly large and important economy to both countries. And in fact, it's responsible for roughly 30% of the combined American and Canadian workforce as well. When you put trade and investment across the border in that context, this region is a key driver of both U.S. and Canadian job growth and also competitiveness.
Lately, President Donald Trump has been talking about a border tax, and that seems to be mostly aimed at Mexico. But how would a border tax in Mexico, and maybe even one at the Canadian border, affect business between the U.S. and Canada and between Canada and Mexico?
Well, when you look at those different tax reform measures, I think what concerns people is two things. One is obviously the applicability at the border itself. When you look at most other developed economies and value-added taxes, they're not collected at the border. So, you know, one concern of business is that you have this tax reform measure that will be potentially applied at the border. And so when you look at the auto sector, for example, which is obviously hugely important to both Michigan and Ontario, when you've got parts crossing the border, you know, five or six times as part of the final assembly of a vehicle, you know, to apply a tax on every transaction, you know, just creates so much more burden, not only on the business in terms of accounting, but also on that supply chain, and really has an impact on the efficiency. So that's one side of it. And then when you look at the other side in terms of providing an exemption or tax benefit for exports and putting a, you know, a tariff or such on imports, there are a lot of businesses on both sides of the border that rely on imports from either country to finish those products. So any kind of tax that is put on those kind of imports that are used for final assembly is going to have an impact on that business. It's going to have an impact on that business's ability to grow. And so obviously, in regions like the Great Lakes, it's a huge concern in terms of, you know, how a measure like that will be thought about, but also implemented.
Well, you'll be hearing from an expert who might know a little bit about that. I saw one of your guests will be the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney.
That's correct.
What do you hope to hear from Mulvaney?
You know, obviously, we know with the new administration, there are a range of different priorities that they campaigned on, that they got elected on, obviously, with the help of many states in the Great Lakes region, from Ohio to Wisconsin to Minnesota. We need to be respectful and mindful of those priorities that elected President Trump. But we also want to hear that there's an ability to be open and understand the dynamics of how some of these cross-border regions like the Great Lakes function on a day-to-day basis, and whether it's regulatory issues, whether it's general trade and investment issues, the economies of the United States and Canada, particularly in regions like the Great Lakes, are so intertwined that we need to be joined up in our conversations about, you know, how we harness and take advantage of the economic strengths that we have in these kind of regions. So we really want to hear from him in terms of what's next, in terms of the president's agenda, the administration's agenda, but that there's an openness to learn and be aware of just how intertwined the two economies really are on both sides of the border in this region.
Your organization also represents tourism groups from both sides of the border. The Trump budget proposal eliminates funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. That's $300 million that was used to clean up legacy pollution, try to restore habitat, and so forth. What does the Council of Great Lakes Region think about those proposals?
When we look at the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, it's a hugely important initiative for both the U.S. and for Canada. You know, when we look at the legacy of environmental issues in the Great Lakes, I think the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which I would say was launched by Republican President George Bush, has really transformed the way that we invest in reclaiming degraded sites across the region and cleaning up areas of concern. And what's important there is that, you know, typically for every dollar that's invested in reclamation and brownfield redevelopment, you know, we've seen upwards of $15 in terms of direct and indirect economic benefits that are generated from those investments. And so there's an economic story that needs to be told here in terms of the benefits of investing in areas of concern and brownfields throughout the region. And obviously, when you're investing in these areas and when you're focused on cleaning up your environment and shorelines and what have you, and creating new spaces for people to visit, you know, that's going to have a positive impact on tourism as well. And so if we don't address issues like, let's say, Lake Erie algae or other issues like that, it's going to have an impact on sport fishing to tourism. And so for us, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is not only a core environmental issue initiative, but it's also a core economic initiative for us.
Yeah, that algae in Lake Erie might also result in contaminated water source, so that's also a problem.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you one last question, and that's about the Windsor to Detroit Gordie Howe International Bridge. Is it going to get attention at the forum, and what's happening to it as far as you know?
Yeah, it certainly will get attention at the forum. So we have Michael Cotillo, who's the president and CEO of the Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority. He'll be speaking at the event. And for us as an organization, when you look at this region, the ports of entry, and mainly our bridges in this region, are responsible for roughly 74% of the total value of goods being shipped across the border by rail, by truck, and to a lesser extent by pipeline. So putting infrastructure into these key corridors is very important for the future of this region's economy. When you look at the Gordie Howe Bridge, it's only going to add additional capacity to our ability to move goods and people around the region and across the border. And so in terms of the status of the bridge itself, my understanding is that the authority is moving through the RFP process to look at potential bidders, what have you, to actually to build the bridge. But we'll be receiving a full update from Michael Cotillo during the forum.
That's Mark Fisher. He's CEO of Council of Great Lakes Region. We've been talking about the Great Lakes Economic Forum, which is being held in Detroit and Windsor next week. Thanks very much for talking with us.
That's great. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who let me rummage through all the microphone cables today. Sadly, highlight of my day. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair and his staff, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.